Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Wait for it. Hold on. All right, very patiently waiting for us is Andy Milburn back in the United States. Andy, what's going on? How are you?
Hey, Mac, how are you? Hey, listen, I've got to begin our discussion today with a comment of what a flashback to IOC I just had. But my it's going to take my family maybe a while to recover, and I've got to maybe have some explaining to do with my wife. But I was hunting around for my headphones, and I was trying to tune into you at the same time. Right. And all of a sudden, your voice comes over loud and clear saying, "And I'm going to crawl up your ass too." Now, in context, it became apparent what you were talking about, but that is what my family heard. And so I quickly stifled you with headphones. And then I was looking for a more private place to talk. And as I was walking through the living room, the headphones came out, and you were inviting everyone to visit Crutch Mountain, I believe. So I, for a dreadful moment, I thought that I had tuned in either to the wrong show, but then your voice was very easily recognizable, and I just thought maybe it was.
Well, Andy, like what? What is wrong with you? You know better than to do crazy shit like that. Yes.
We're good, you know. I will explain afterwards.
Well, yeah, you should. Well, maybe not, because if your wife finds out the truth, you might be in trouble.
That is true.
You might. But
Mac, to hear your dulcet tones again, man.
I know. First of all, your voice sounds a little bit different now that you're a little bit closer, and so welcome home. And what's the thing you most enjoy about coming home?
Oh, that's a tough one. You know, the kids. I mean, it's just like as it has always been for your listeners coming back from deployment, although by no stretch of the imagination am I comparing my little 2-week junkets overseas to a deployment. But yeah, you're really just coming home to the kids. Every time I come home, they appear very excited. I sometimes wonder what it would be like to live at home all the time and absolutely not travel, and whether I would just become boring old dad. I suspect I would, but that's pretty much it.
I don't know that they would complain about you becoming boring old dad, though. So just for the record, you want to know one of the things that I always think of when I come home from places like that, which has been a while now, but at some point you get in the car or you're on a bus going from like March Air Force Base in Riverside to Pendleton, which was my normal. And you get on an American freeway, right? It has lines, it has signs, right? They fix the holes. You know, it's just the infrastructure that is the United States. You look at it, and when you haven't been around it in a while, and it's just this marvel. It's just this American marvel that it all works, right? We service it, and we repair it. And you have all these people and all these nice cars going about their lives. And then you come from a place that is so not like that. And you just, it always reminds me of the thought of winning the ovarian lottery and being born American, right? When you could have been born something vastly different. But certainly your children as well. But again, you go to parts of the world where, you know, you splice off the power grid, you know, right, by the local dude who can run a wire into your house, and it looks like a hornet's nest, and then it goes from there, and a little bit different here in the United States. Who's your favorite president? If you could meet one president, living or dead, who would that be?
You know, I suppose everyone is going to default to Lincoln, and I am no different. You know, what do you expect from me, George Washington? I think he made a dreadful mistake.
I said that. I had Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenney on last week, and I said the same thing. I said, I know this is going to be boring, but man, I would love to sit down and hear Lincoln talk in long format about, you know, his challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really hands down no competition.
No,
But they, you know, this morning, this isn't a plug for me, but this morning I was on POTUS. Have you heard of POTUS on Sirius Radio?
You bet.
Yeah. So I had an opportunity to be interviewed this morning. It's quite early at 7:20.
POTUS. They concentrate on American politics. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it was a big deal today because it was President's Day. But they wanted to ask me, this is a very interesting question, actually. It's about the, you know, the war powers resolution that Senator Kaine is trying to push through. And, you know, their question for me, I think they were expecting like a single, you know, a couple of sentence answers because they'd introduced me as a Marine, you know, like, yeah, good, yeah, or bad. But, you know, what I said, and for your listeners, by the way, I will keep this succinct. So here's, you know, a Marine's perspective, as simple as possible on war powers. You know, I said to them, hey, look, by both Constitution and statute, Congress already has a significant ability to influence, provide oversight, and curtail the executive's you know, ability to go to war. You know, everyone knows Congress has it's vested in Congress by the Constitution both to declare war and to decide if and how to fund that war. But as we all know, too, in practice, that breaks down. It breaks down first because this country or the executive, regardless of administration, since the Second World War, has found pretty clever ways to avoid declaring war. And the second piece is, you know, the funding piece. What congressman in his right mind is going to vote against funding a war that has already started and thus be painted by his own constituents as undermining the troops? So, you know, those sound like pretty significant powers. In practice, they are not. And so, you know, again, I'm keeping this under 2 minutes. So then you get to 1973 and the War Powers Act, the War Powers Resolution, the aftermath of Vietnam.
Right.
Two significant aspects of that. Number one, President has to inform Congress of employment of troops and hostilities overseas within 48 hours of it happening. And by the way, that actually happened in the aftermath of the Soleimani attack. Number two.
Yeah, but they didn't like it though, right? They wanted to be informed before.
But don't cut into my time, man. I'm on a 2-minute surge and we'll get back to it.
All right, I'm the timekeeper. Hey. I'm fucking on radio, man. I don't know what got into you if you're drinking already this morning, but you better be careful.
All right, War Powers Act, number two, the most significant aspect. Remember, this is 1973. The War Powers Act says that within 60 days of U.S. troops being involved in hostility overseas, the president needs the explicit permission of Congress to continue hostilities, and that should come in the form of declaration of war or authorized use of military force. And if that does not occur, the president is compelled within 30 days to withdraw troops from overseas. Fast forward, right? 2001. I'm getting to a point here. So 2001. AUMF, authorized use of military force, passed by Congress to bypass the War Powers Act or in accordance with the War Powers Act, specifically to go after Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. 1 year later, 2002, AUMF 2, and the wording of that is for the sake of national security, use of force against a threat posed by Iraq. Now, you and I both know over the course of the next two decades, because the problem with the AUMF was there's no sunset provision. It just continues, right? There's no requirement for the review. There's not even a requirement to debate the inclusion of other groups. So successive administrations have stretched the AUMF to cover various groups who were not even in existence in 2001, you know, to include ISIS.
Right.
All right. No argument for me there necessarily. Okay. The only problem I have with that is that if there was a sunset provision to review original goals, then that would perhaps have required the executive to really examine what our purpose was in Afghanistan, because we've gone from in accordance with AOMF-1, pursuing the Taliban and al-Qaeda, great goals, to, hey, while we're here, let's establish a Jeffersonian democracy, to, hey, let's just try and make this place less of a shithole than it was before, to, I don't know what we're doing here, but if we pull all our guys out now, it's going to look like defeat, right? Yeah. So the guys deploying to Afghanistan now, many of them were not even born when that AOMF was passed. All right, so already we're kind of, we have issues there with unchecked use of you know, war powers by the executive. Then along comes the Iranian threat. This is not a political argument, as usual here. I'm just, you know, pointing it out. There is no way by any stretch of the imagination that you can extend the wording of either AOMF to cover Iran, which means we're back to the War Powers Act. But as I pointed out earlier, you know, so the president's hit on Soleimani, consensus legally, you know, legally strong grounds, because you, at that level, you can't, you can't talk about a sense of immediate imminence when you're talking about self-defense. He was on strong grounds too, frankly, you know, under his Article 2 powers within the Constitution, you know, safeguarding the United States, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no provision at all for him to anticipate probable consequences. That's where we are right now. However, if he launches into a war with Iran, he is not legally covered by any stretch of the imagination by either AUMF. And the problem is that if we commit troops to hostilities, he can continue to do that for 60 days before Congress demands that he withdraw them. I can't imagine, regardless of the composition of any Congress, anyone voting to say, okay, hey, in the face of the enemy, let's pull our guys back. So you know, bottom line is the war powers resolution that Cain tried to push through, it's a bipartisan effort. It had a common sense clause in there, which was that within, you know, 30 days of hostilities, that the president would need either a declaration of war or a new AOMF from Congress. And I think, you know, amidst all the partisan chatter, I would hope that most American citizens regard that as being a pretty reasonable requirement, especially when we're talking about committing this nation's youth to another war. And that, in turn, I know I'm over 10 minutes, man, I'm coming to an end. That, in turn, comes back to what you and I have discussed a number of times, and we will not solve unless we bring in the draft, which you may prefer. I don't know yet. I'm undecided. And that is, there's no incentive at all for Congress really to get involved in this, because they have no skin in the game. The vast majority of their constituents have no prospect of serving in the military. They don't have sons and daughters in the military, because we comprise a tiny percentage of the U.S. population. So without that, without media attention, this is very unlike Vietnam. There's unlikely to be a successful passage of the War Powers, you know, resolution, you know, and if you look at the opposition to it, everyone's pulling the Patriot card, because it's very easy when you don't have anyone, you know, having to pay the price for this, to pull the Patriot card, right, and say, hey, you're trying to handcuff the president from doing what he needs to do against Iran. And the answer I would say is, no, we're just trying to bring this back within the intent of the Constitution, that Congress has some real oversight over the powers of the executive. Done, man. Two minutes. I wasn't timing out. I'd say 2 minutes.
Yeah, you were very close,
man. You interrupted me.
Okay, so let's talk about his authority to whack Soleimani. Soleimani had been a player in the Iraq War, yes?
Yeah. Yeah, so absolutely. So, you know, one thing I find funny about this, Mac, Soleimani was
let me just get the exacto knife out. So because of that, Soleimani winds up a target on our target list. Okay? And to me, that's absolutely legitimate based on what Soleimani did to us in Iraq in that war. He was a participant. right? He was a, he was like the black hand of the mafia in that war. So, but you what? So, if I'm correct in listening to you, whacking Soleimani is one thing that's covered under the AUMF, but further escalation of combat operations against Iran is not.
Yeah, to be clear, it's not covered under AUMF. It's not, it's covered under reasonable, the you know, the definition of the president's powers under Article 2, I think it's Section 2 of the Constitution. And so in there, you know, he can take, it's always been interpreted legally, he can take reasonable steps without notifying Congress beforehand to take action.
And, so, and but so that doesn't cite his actions in Iraq during the war. What it says is what he was in the region planning to do, right?
Yeah, that's right. So based on not on, you know, kind of revenge for what he did, but rather on defensive U.S. personnel interest overseas.
Got it.
And again, there, I don't think you have to have a very high bar for imminence. I think that those who are opposing that move are a little bit on thin ice, there's really nothing concrete to say that that decision was illegal. Here's the only two provisos that I would offer. Okay, number one is that, again, as we talked about earlier, there's kind of an implicit requirement or hope that this is part of a coherent strategy rather than whack-a-mole. Right. As we talked about, you know, the Iranians have the ability to strike back at us asymmetrically. That whole facade over the firing missiles had nothing to do with Iranian real intentions. So, you know, that's number one. Number two is probable consequences. And again, this isn't, you know, I'm happy to see Soleimani dead. This isn't a, you know, me being a kind of Chicken Little about this, but it gets back to, it's tied in with the thing about having a coherent strategy. So probable consequences, the Iranians are very proud people. We have essentially unified even the opposition in their opposition to us by killing Soleimani. That's just, you know, that's a downside of this. That's a disadvantage. I'm not saying that it should be, overrule the decision. I'm just saying that I hope someone, you know, brought that into effect, and then that we had a cohesive information operations plan, strategic operations plan to explain why we did it to the Iranian people as well as to the world. And that seems to be lacking. So bottom line is legally unobjectionable, ethically, absolutely, you know, unobjectionable. But in pragmatic terms, there seems to be something missing in how this was planned. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't know that I'd agree with you, though. I think that maybe you could certainly start down that.
Disagree with me, man. You invited me on by saying you just simply cheerleaders went along.
So I think that you could, while we may have been headed down that road, the shoot down of the airliner. And then the subsequent
back in 89.
No.
The recent
one. And then the Iranians lying about it, right? Undercut. So you saw demonstrations in support of Soleimani quickly turn into anti-government demonstrations. So I think while you may be right, I think the discontent there is so substantial.
I think that
fate intervened in the form of the Iranian government lying to the Iranian people, and they knew it, right? They have enough access.
That's a great point. Fate, yeah, just by now,
you
by
know, and
fate.
Yeah, yeah, and I will tell you this: you don't get that perspective from American media. You have to watch Al Qaeda, which I do. When I go looking for stuff about Iran, I don't necessarily read too much American stuff. You'll find very, very interesting guests and very, very interesting perspective on Iran from Al Qaeda, and not Al Qaeda, Al Jazeera. What am I saying? So I would say, don't be afraid when there are things happening in the Middle East. Turn on Al Jazeera and listen to a completely different perspective from a completely different part of the world and a completely different worldview. And they have, you know, whether it be Islamic scholars or and Iranian scholars, and they have them all on, and some of them will piss you off because they'll tell you that America is the great Satan and Iran, blah, 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 blah. But I think it's a I've tried hard to learn about Iran.
It's actually a very balanced, you know, I agree. I mean, General Petraeus himself, before he was caught scrogging Paula, used to say, you know, that that Al Jazeera and the BBC were the two news outlets that never misquoted him and always put things in context. And I think that's fair. You know, Al Jazeera is a serious, you know, they do give an alternate viewpoint, and so that's great. But they always give, if you notice, they always give U.S. Officials an opportunity to make statements. Now, we often give them, like, idiots, not very smart statements. I mean, but they do give us that opportunity.
Well, again, I mean, American politicians tend to be speaking to an American audience, and when you see them in the context of an international audience, it sounds a little tone deaf. Not going to lie to you, sounds a little tone deaf.
Couldn't agree more.
All right, let's talk about.
So here we are. So we talked about the death, assassination of Soleimani. All right, done. We are fortunate now that there was not an immediate asymmetric backlash. There may still be, so now we're in this nether region of what happens next. And I think, you know, in that gap, I think that would have been good timing, perhaps to push through this war powers resolution, just to make clear.
Here's what I find curious, Andy, is that it's going nowhere. In order for something to become law,
right? There's a couple of reasons why it's going nowhere. We've got a ridiculously partisan Congress right now. Right. Number one, number two, the executive can play the patriot card, and number three, most of these dudes on the Hill don't give a shit because they just don't have enough constituents with sons and daughters in the military. Those are three good reasons why that war resolution did not pass.
Well, you know, and so it can pass the Senate, and what's odd is that, first of all, it's not going to become law because Trump's not going to sign it, and they don't have the votes to override it. So when you see these headlines about Senate votes to curtail, right, the president's war powers authority, right, it's bullshit. It's a bullshit headline because it ain't going to happen. The question that I find interesting is, knowing that it's not going to happen, Senate Republicans, right, join Senate Democrats in message sending in a very public way, which is not going to ingratiate you to anybody. So I found that real, knowing that it's dead on arrival, it's never going to happen. I found that the most interesting part of it is, okay, we're going to play charades here, and you're going to do it in public, in front of the president, and so you're going to message send in public. So I thought that the Republicans who joined the Democrats, I thought that was kind of interesting. Thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I that gives me some hope, Mac, that there are enough guys who do have that you know, depth of moral courage and vote
there's
according
not.
To
they're politicians.
Principle.
There's not,
but not enough. But not, enough. Yeah, I mean, so. You and I both.
I don't want you to get your hopes up
in politics. Yeah, no, I do trust.
Oh, it is though, Andy. It is about politics. You don't know politicians if you don't know that.
Yeah, but no, I'm saying my viewpoint on this isn't about politics.
Oh.
I'm not a default, hey, the administration is right or wrong, whatever they do. And too many people I know are. It doesn't matter what happens. The people will comment according to their political views, not according to, you know, a kind of a rational step back. What is the best for the country?
So in spite of your appearance on POTUS satellite radio, you're not a talking head. That's what you're selling me.
I wasn't a talking head until today, but now I'm thinking if I can earn enough money just being a talking head, trust me, man.
Exactly.
But I'm a talking head for the good, you know, so I don't have to.
We'll be the judge of that.
Yeah.
All right. Final thoughts on. Let me tee up some stuff that I want to talk to you about. Well, yes, you were in Somalia. and we had a conversation while you were there about security is not being confined to FOBs. Anything you want to say to amplify that? Anything you saw in your last week or 10 days while you were there? Anything else that is broken squelch? I mean, I again, for me, it's un-fucking believable that we had another soldier killed, right, at another base in Africa.
Three Americans killed.
Right, yeah. So what, it was two contractors and one soldier? And then and after the four that we lost, what, 18 months ago or whatever? I mean, how the fuck can that happen? How can every time we put somebody out there, question one is security, question two is medevac support, question two, Bravo, is close air support? All right. So until you can answer these questions, we're not going to hang Americans out to get killed again. I just find it amazing. So anyway, any further comments on that?
Again, I'll give you an Andy Milburn 45-second. No, let's make it 38 seconds on this. So everything that goes wrong operationally can be traced to a misunderstanding between mission and risk, and a lack of shared perception at each level of the chain of command of mission and risk. And, you know, bottom line, that is what's happening now in Africa. At four-star level, you've got guys who have forgotten what they learned as lieutenants, which is if you cede, that is for the benefit of you, Max, cede means give up. If you cede your freedom of movement, you know, around a stationary base, then you're inviting yourself to be attacked. So you've got people at four-star level misunderstand the mission, which is go after, degrade, dismantle, defeat al-Shabaab by with and through partner nation forces. They misunderstand that, and they misunderstand the risk. They think it's too scary to send dudes out to build those, you know, both the tangible and intangible benefits to develop that partnership with local partner nation forces in order to accomplish the mission.
How is that possible, given all the years of us fighting, and whenever you develop a firm base, whenever you expand your footprint, right, these are the exact same questions you ask. How is that even fucking possible that when I look at the map and my ops guys brief me, oh, and we're moving here, all right, how is not, okay, service these three targets, one, security, two, medevac, three, close air support. How is that possible, Andy? I don't understand that.
All right, speculating. We don't always necessarily, this may come as a shock as you, this is just an observation after 31 years in the military. We don't necessarily always promote the most intellectually acute or morally courageous guys to general officer rank. Okay, you're going to say, Andy, are you kidding me?
No, I'm not. I'm going to say that, no, the conformists, the bobblehead.
The
bobblehead.
The process doesn't support that.
Yeah, the bobblehead conformist gets promoted.
Number two, by the time you reach four-star rank, frankly, you know, someone said to me, who's a three-star, he said, hey, you know, it doesn't matter what rank you're at. By the time you make general, you are leaning forward in your seat, thinking about your next assignment, where you can go to next, even as a four-star. And so, you know, I think it's honestly, and this isn't me being too simplistic, it's you got a four-star who's like, I'm going to spend I've got two years. I don't care about catastrophic success, but I do care about catastrophic failure. I'm going to avoid failure, and I'm going to do that. Although they don't word it this way to them, I'm going to do that by violating every single tenet of our own doctrine of mission command in order to do that, because only I understand mission and only I understand risk. And so that's why you get situations where a Marine Special Operations company on the ground has to submit for four-star approval a CONOP to leave the perimeter, to conduct operations of the partner nation force. Whereas, you know, anyone who has done Special Operations 101 or Advising 101 knows you can't get there from here. You cannot build that level of trust unless you are sharing some element of danger with your partner nation force. And there are tangible benefits, as we know, to, you know, fire support, intelligence, everything else that physical accompaniment brings to the fight that nothing short of that can. But gets lost at four-star level. Maybe, maybe we don't have to defeat al-Shabaab. Maybe if we just kind of hunker down and let the Somali, God help us, but let the, you know, Somalis do it for themselves, eventually it'll happen. And they just don't understand what a delicate balance there is right now between the good and the bad in Somalia.
But how can that be? I mean, didn't everybody get served notice, Andy, after, you know, what happened in Mali? Didn't everybody get the memo that, hey, we got to make sure we protect people?
Well, Mali actually got people, you know, Mali's what frightened everyone into hunkering down more. But Mali wasn't about
hunkering down then? We didn't hunker down good enough?
No. Mali was simply about a total misunderstanding of mission and risk at every level.
I know. I'm talking about the aftermath of Mali. So now it happens to us again. We get more guys killed by somebody who balls up on us and overruns.
Mali was the freaking... I'm sorry, going back. What was the last part?
No. It's like, okay, in the aftermath of Mali, right, we look at this thing, right? And do we, how do we secure these guys? How do we support them? How do we medevac them? Right. And so to me, I don't understand how the last event happens in the aftermath of Mali.
Well, let's take, absolutely. So let's take Somalia as an example. There is a robust capability to support the guys on the ground. From fast support from the air, contracted, and it works very well.
Okay.
And SOCAP's done a terrific job there. And there is also the ability to CASAVAC. Now, it's probably quicker than anyone could expect in Africa, with U.S. assets. So all that part of it has been fixed. And again, what happened in Niger wasn't necessarily about lack of assets. It was about just not knowing when to queue them up because there was inadequate discussions between the chains of command. So my point is, the pieces are in place. This isn't Andy Milburn just saying, hey, let's get out there and gun after the enemy willy-nilly. I mean, we have the safeguards.
So then what happened in Africa when we get Americans killed?
Oh, you mean recently in Manda Bay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So a number of things. I don't know if you read the New York Times article, but that whole, for a start, there was no unity of command. There wasn't even unity of effort as far as defensive measures on that base. I mean, it was in a huge cluster. Number two, as we talked about, nothing was happening outside the wire. Nothing. So you've got a base. I don't know if you've been to Manda Bay, but the jungle, it's just like what we learn at very low tactical level. I mean, the jungle encroaches right onto the perimeter. So you've got terrain that's just rife for setting up an attack like that. And if you aren't plowing the ground around there with patrols and, keeping the enemy off balance, then you're inviting them to be able to do something like that. So, there's a number of proximate reasons why that attack happened, why it was fairly successful. But those were those are the two main ones. I mean, it was just gross incompetence. It was just fortunate for everyone concerned that it happened in the immediate aftermath of the Soleimani attack. So, America's attention was elsewhere. The media's attention was elsewhere, with the exception of, the New York Times wrote that excellent article. And I want to say I read one other article. I can't remember what publication it was in that talked about what an incredible dog's breakfast that event was. But the dudes responsible will go unpunished, I'm sure.
Again, I at some point, I mean, when you're in charge, there should be the one question, court-martial, and that is, General, were you in charge on this day of this year of this command? Yes, I was. Okay, thank you. Your excuse.
It doesn't happen at a higher level. I mean, think about the aftermath of Niger where those four guys were killed. They went after the frickin' company commander, for Christ's sake. They went after the ODT. I mean, it's just like when you read through that investigation and the list, the screw ups went all the way up to, frankly, to SOCAF and beyond. And yet, what do they do in the aftermath? They go after.
Well,
they go
after but General Mattis had put that aside and said, that's not what I want. And he was but he never completed that, which would have been interesting.
Then aftermath, nothing. You know, people just let it lie because you can't disrupt careers, man. Guys may not make general, star.
The next question: how? Why does it make sense? Explain to us the move of first raters, in your opinion, to the East Coast. Good thing, bad thing, or what?
I mean, PNG from the one organization that kind of like took me into its fold. I don't have strong feelings either way. I know you're going to say, hey, this is a non-answer. I'm just being absolutely honest with you. And this, I don't have strong feelings either way. I can't think of the, you know, a strong rationale to have done this, but again, I wasn't in the discussions. Right. On the other hand, there's probably intangible benefits. Yes, you are uprooting guys who've been in Pendleton for a long, long time, but they are giving them a fair amount of warning. I think it's, you know, it's not going to happen until 2022. And maybe there were concerns that there were, you know, that there was kind of a disparity between first MRB and the other two based on geographic location. Maybe there's a feeling that, you know, sharing of TTPs and just building of cohesion would benefit from having them all three co-located. And those are strong reasons. And the only downside is that you are uprooting guys, but again, you've given them that benefit. I would say, it's, you know, one downside I can think about though is, man, that's an awesome facility. Have you seen that out there on the West Coast?
No.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you would look at that and go, "Is this just a battalion headquarters? It's palatial. I mean, it's absolutely. It's a beautiful facility. So
where is it? Where are they located at Pendleton?
It's Polgus.
Oh, really?
Do you remember Polgus?
Yeah, you bet. That's just there.
Yeah,
just there.
You know, I mean, there's something about Pendleton too, isn't there? I mean, it's just a magical place, you know, and. I know people are going to think I've lost my mind since I retired and I'm seeing things through rosy lenses, but it is, you know, I mean, it's just a beautiful camp and there's those areas we look down on just vast, deep blue as far as you can see with the Pacific. And I mean, I'm very nostalgic for Pendleton.
I was just there on Saturday. I had a dinner for the last dinner, the 75th dinner. For Iwo Jima, the 75th anniversary dinner for Iwo Jima veterans. It's the last one they hold because their numbers are few and it's more and more difficult for them to get there. But what a wonderful night. And I want to say about 28 of them were there. I met a guy who was in the Navy. He's 100 years old. He still lives by himself in Pacific Beach in San Diego.
Wow.
Yeah. And so you meet these, and you meet their families. I met another guy who I interviewed last week by the name of Tony Kappa. And Tony grew up in, was born and raised in Inglewood, California, up in Los Angeles. And he joins the Navy, thinks he joins the Navy. And he's at the MEPS downtown Los Angeles in a room with 9 other guys. He was a sheet metal guy in a airplane factory. So he thought, yeah, the Navy can use my skills. So he's standing there with his folder and going through the whole thing. Guy walks in and says, hey, U-9?
Yeah.
You guys are now United States Marines. Fights in one fight. That's with the 4th Marine Division on Iwo Jima. And, you know, got a chance to – I'd interviewed him, got a chance to meet him in person and spend some time with him. And, no, it is. I mean, it's a place that, you know, that has historical significance for those guys. And to today, no. And it is absolutely beautiful, the Pacific Ocean. So,
what a tremendous event, Mac. I mean, I'm glad you got invited there. You know what I love about meeting those guys, too, is that, you know, even though they are like 90s or, you know, as you mentioned, this one guy's 100, you can see traces in them of guys that you know now or have served with. You know, I mean, it strikes me again and again that there's some familiarity, there's a commonality in the culture, you know, the sense of humor, same sort of sense of humor, the same, manner of speaking, the the undercurrent of camaraderie. You know, these aren't just empty words. Marines that were, despite what anyone may say about old Corps, new Corps, the Marines that fought on Iwo Jima have a lot of similarities with the Marines that, you know, with whom you and I have served. I mean, I always say that the Marines that were with me in Mogadishu in 92 were very similar to the Marines that I served with in Iraq in 2016.
It was awesome. I mean, you see the flag with 48 stars on the wall, right? And that starts it. Yeah. And then, yep. Hello?
No, I'm here, man.
Oh,
I was uncharacteristically quiet. I was on my seat listening to you.
And then they had all the weapons, and then there was some personal photographs and stuff that was up, and you know, it was just these guys' version of going to, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan. Theirs was Iwo Jima. It's not what they intended. It's certainly not what they signed up for. They signed up to serve, and this is where they went. And so, the stories are unbelievable. And just to be in their company, because they are Marine Corps royalty.
Well, Iwo Jima is just it's an iconic event in our history, isn't it? Right, really, right. I mean, you know, who in our generation didn't see John Wayne in Sands of Iwo Jima, and or read Battle Cry, Leon Uris, and those were powerful motivators for us, and it's just shaping our vision of the Corps. That's tremendous.
Talk to me about, you just went and spoke at Command and Staff. First of all, hats off. Who's running Command and Staff these days?
Man. Tom, if you're listening, big shout out to you. Tom's got a number of claims to fame. First of all, he's a tanker who made it to colonel and has had and has commanded as a colonel. More importantly, he has a whiskey collection that I have that's just unrivaled, and I've helped him many a times sample it. But you know, thirdly, and I think anyone who knows Tom will back this up. He's and just a superb officer.
What's his last name? Tom what?
Gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N. And so he was MILSEC to the commandant, to General Nella. You know, he's had some hard tours, man. I mean, he's labored away in the salt mines at Mars Sent. This is a Benny to him, and he is just the right guy to head up Command and Staff, because he's got that, you know, he's youthful enthusiasm, but he's also very highly respected because based on his background. So yeah, he invited me about 2 months ago it's a new class, Moral, Courage, and Descent. And I was delighted to be able to go and teach it. As you and I have spoken about this many times, it's a topic that's commonly misunderstood. And I fielded some really ignorant responses to some of the stuff that I've written. You know, hey man, it's all about you obey legal orders, you disobey illegal orders, et cetera, et cetera. What is so difficult about this to understand? And what people do not understand, most people do, but some do not, and I feel quite concerned that if they're still in the Corps, is that we have, you know, we belong to a profession, number one. Number two, that profession has an oath of office and has a code of ethics, and sometimes those clash with direct orders from chain of command, legal or illegal. And when that happens, guess what should take precedence in Andy Millman's view and most of our view? It's your oath to the Constitution and your code of ethics. And it was well timed. You know, I posted just a photo of me giving the talk at Command and Staff, and it had like 15,000 views within a couple of days on LinkedIn, and that isn't because I'm a handsome dude. I think it was because it happened to coincide with the whole Vindman case, right? You know, so here you've got a dude who I believe was following his code of ethics and his oath to the Constitution, which was gave him a sense of loyalty to the nation, and it clashed with his orders from his direct chain of command, or a sense of loyalty to his direct chain of command, which happened also to include his commander in chief. And so he, you know, he followed his what he thought was his code of ethics. And I would hope most of us in uniform concur with that. And it led to consequences. Are you still there, Mac?
I am. I'm listening.
Yeah. So it led to consequences. So he has been unceremoniously fired from the NSC in a manner that was unnecessarily humiliating. Those who saw it tell me. And his the real litmus test now, Mac. His really the way this will really tell us what the institution has come to. Will the Army stand by him? By that I mean, if I was General Milley, and General Milley, I'm sure if he's listening to this, is saying, "Well, thank God you're not." But if I was, I would see this as an absolute watershed in deciding whether we are a profession with our own code of ethics. And if we are, then Vindman needs to be put in a position that is which makes it clear to everyone that his actions are condoned. It's supported by the institution. In other words, you know, whether or not he was in the running for colonel, he should probably make colonel now. You know what I'm saying? And for the good of the institution, because if he doesn't, then that sends the wrong message. Does that make sense?
No, I mean, but again, the bar is so low on what is an American politician these days. I mean, would you expect anything different than him being unceremoniously escorted from the grounds of the White House when you get in the way of the political narrative? I mean, to me, I'm not Pollyanna, right? But he's got a duty to the country first, and he executed that. General Kelly came out and said as much. Headline from 3 days ago: the Army will not investigate.
Not investigate? Holy crap!
Yeah, how about that?
It's not about could he be investigated, for Christ's sake. You know, so it's not about investigating him. It's about now taking care of him because he was removed,
right. No, but that's what the flamethrower on Twitter said, that that's what President Trump said, that the military would take a look at whether Vindman should face military action, right? Yeah. And then I just want to say who made the statement, whether it was – I know Esper at one point, I think, said something on Friday or Saturday that the Army would not be investigating Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. So I think that is a done deal. So they could stand by to get wire brushed now.
Well, yeah, not investigate, but what is going to happen to him? And I can tell you, you know, that there are a lot of field grade officers in the military, not just the Army, watching now to see what happens. And I've heard a little bit of idiocy from some guys in uniform about Vindman's actions, you know, being selfish or this or that. And I can only ascribe that to people whose brains are scrambled by a partisan, you know, BS.
Right.
Because regardless of politics, again, this was a great example of professional obligations, oath of office, which isn't always easy to interpret. Oath to the Constitution. Shit, we've got nine Supreme Court justices who can't decide what exactly the Constitution means all the time. But we holding the commission do have to interpret that sometimes. And this was one case where a relatively junior officer was asked to do that.
It's interesting because General Kelly made comments about this last week, and then he got the flamethrower taken to him. But what General Kelly said, look, there's other agencies, right? And his portfolio was the Ukraine, right, Lieutenant, and that's why he was listening on the call. And so what he did was he alerted other agencies that this was taking place, and he thought it inappropriate, right? So he alerted his superiors. That's exactly what he's trained to do.
I think you have to go through all kinds of mental gyrations to come up with a reason, you know, to say that he did anything but his duty. Right. Yeah. So
Right, right. And so,
but it's a very interesting case, right? And so it was well timed that I happened to speak to Command and Staff College on the same day, and I think it went well. You know, feedback was good. Tom said all the feedback was positive, and I think that's honestly because I gave it a balanced view, and I did absolutely represent the view of the chain of thought of very, very traditionalist, where obedience trumps everything, and because otherwise you're on a slippery slope, right? There's no, you know, once you start saying, hey, it's okay to disobey orders, which I don't, by the way, I just say there are competing obligations. Sometimes you may have to disobey an order, but guess what? You take the consequences. That's what moral courage is about. And that's why holding a commission is a serious thing.
I don't think that's the most significant question, though. Here's what I would tell you. Our misadventures in both Afghanistan, and you outlined them earlier, and also in Iraq. The road to all of that was paved by flag officers and general officers of the United States military. And so if the only litmus test is, you know, if it's not immoral, unethical, or illegal, you follow it, that's your oath. That's your oath to the nation. I mean, don't you, as one of the key holders of the American military, don't you have a larger obligation to prevent the nation from doing things, right, that will not be in its best interest?
It's an escalation of force. This is how I look at it, all right? You're absolutely right. So we use this horrible cliche, best military advice, and time and again, you know, some guys, without even thinking about this, just spout all this BS, you know, moral or illegal or immoral or illegal. What does that mean? There is a gray area mile wide, even legal versus illegal orders. What about enhanced interrogation, military tribunals at Gitmo, two examples, CPA order number one. Okay, to put all of that aside, all right? Best military advice. Okay, so a 3 or 4 star officer's best military advice, and the president says, "Hey, thank you for your interest in national security, but no, we're going to do this." Okay, so then you got a choice: you either execute, shut up and execute, right, or you resign. But one general in the last 2 decades, Greg Newbold, has resigned over a question of principle. The majority of them has just gone, "Okay, boss, I'll troll along." All right, so far, so good. Now, here's what I think a lot of generals just they don't understand. And I know if there's generals listening to this going, "Hey, dude, you know, you got out as an 06. Who are you to question?"
What do you understand?
So here's what they don't understand. Okay, man, when you troll along and execute, you own the consequences of those actions. You can't simply say, "Hey, man, I was told to do this, and I said, hey, it's not a good idea, but, you know, he's the president, and now I'm doing it." So if you continue to execute a war, and I'm just hypothetical, for instance, continue to execute a war in which we're losing guys, and there are no very clear political objectives, there's no political objectives, really, that makes sense to you, so indecipherable goals, and you do that year after year simply because 5-6 years ago, you voiced an opinion, or maybe you didn't even voice opinion. You're just doing it because, hey, you got told to do that. You own those consequences. That's my point. So until you actually make a stand and say, "Hey, wait a second, we really do need some political objectives here for the loss of this blood and treasure to make sense," there should be some coherent plan. And if there isn't, then it doesn't matter what campaign I come up with year after year, however good we do on the ground, we're going to lose guys for no reason. And if you're not willing to say that, you certainly own the consequences. I think that's what people miss out on. Number two, okay, so say you're the one guy in the world or one guy in the U.S. military to resign on a question of principle, which is, again, I think, quite a sad statistic. And, Joe, I'm a big fan of General Newbold. He was my new commander. But even if I never had met him, I would be a big fan of his because of his stand on principle, even though at the time I didn't agree with him.
Well, I want to make one point about General Newbold, and that's this. And, General Newbold did that before the event, okay? He didn't go, right, command the organization, right, and, you know, fulfill his childhood dream, and then come back and say, okay, now that I've done that, let me tell you what I think.
Now I'm out. I'm going to – yeah, exactly. Now you know, here's what's sad is we keep talking about General Newbold, singular, right? So the point is, all right, hey, so here's number two. So say you say, all right, I'm going to offer my best military advice, the escalation of force, right? I'm going to also offer my best military advice. All right, President SecDef, hey, I don't want to hear it. And then you say, okay, in that case, I'm going to resign on principle. Now, does that mean you are – do you own – is that – does that resignation alone absolve you? Or is it the act of that, or is it the effect? Do you still have to do your best to avert disastrous consequences?
You still have to do your best to avert disastrous consequences.
Yeah. So resign and you either shut up and don't say anything and drift into life and write a book.
No.
Or you speak up, you go to Congress and the media, hey, I want to explain why this is a bad idea.
Exactly. I think.
I'm not saying either it's right and wrong, but it needs to be a deliberate decision, right?
Right, right.
Because if it's the consequences you care about, then you should continue to want to affect those consequences, right. Not merely say, hey, I've done my bit, man.
Right.
I resign.
Your moral obligation does not end, right, if you've sworn that oath, when you say, okay, I'm going to resign. I believe if that's the sequence of events, you have an absolute moral obligation to articulately lay out the argument why you disagree with the policy.
Think about it instead of hide behind I don't believe in it. So it's very interesting. When I was getting beaten up over an article I wrote in 2010 and various academics and policy wonks were calling for me to resign my commission, all of which happened. So I was an 05 in SOCUR. And Admiral Stavridis was the UCOM commander, and he called me to his office, and I thought, oh, shit, you know, he's gonna just destroy me over this article. And he didn't. He sat me down. He said, hey, man, Eddie, I read your article. I actually agree with you. And so I had to pose this question. You know, I said, hey, sir, see you had to resign on a question of principle. What do you think then? Do you then shut up, or do you still have to do everything you can to pursue the effect of avoiding disastrous consequence? And he thought for a moment. He said, "Oh, I would go to the media and to Congress. I think it's the effect that is important." So I'm not saying that is right, or, you know, necessarily right or wrong, but I'm saying that you know that at least he thought through that as rather than just kind of a default. When you hear people say, "Well, people should shut up after they resign," well, it depends on the circumstances, dude. There's nothing quite as simple as that. Escalation of force continuing. So now there is a chain of thought that says this. It's very interesting. It is, hey, listen, I don't agree with this. I think it's going to be disastrous, or it's not going to. But if I stay in position, maybe I can mitigate the bad effects of this crappy plan. Okay. Now some of your listeners are thinking, okay, yep, we've heard that argument recently.
99.9% say that, right?
Yeah. So there's two ways to do that, right? One is to continue to object, which won't get you far with probably, you know, it may do, you know, if you've got a receptive administration, but otherwise, no, you're just going to be forced out again. Or now we get into disobedience, right? Or you slow roll some of the decisions that you think are likely to lead to the disaster. Or you, so you've got a choice, right? Blatant disobedience. Right, number one. Number two, kind of slow rolling, covert disobedience. Or third, you embark on an alternate course of action. Hey, we're going to, you know, I want plans drawn up to hit Iran's cultural centers with, you know, just hypothetical situation, right? Cruise missiles. Okay, boss, yeah, we're working on those plans. But then you start working up a plans for a cyber campaign to launch against Iran, which you haven't been asked for. But you think, hey, once I plan this and present it, boss is going to like this to this crazy idea about the cultural sites, right? Hey, getting back to so some people would say, and I'm not necessarily saying this, some people would say, yes, we saw two contrasts in that approach recently among senior officials in the Trump administration, namely General Mattis and General McMaster. Some people would say McMaster – voiced his might voice his objection, but then he was the okay boss. Continue, we'll do. You know, and so that might explain why you see a guy who made a lot of kudos, who got a lot of kudos for writing Dereliction of Duty, still just troll ahead and with weak defenses of the war in Afghanistan. There are some
until that point at which he left.
Yeah. There are some who suggest, like, you know, for instance, Guy Snodgrass, who just wrote the book, Holding the Line. Yeah, are you tracking that book, Mac? Guy Snodgrass was a general speechwriter. And he just wrote it. He wrote a book called Holding the Line. You know, I forget the subtitle, but it's basically, you know, serving with Mattis in Trump's administration. Whatever. And in there, he intimates, well, actually really says that or describes that General Mattis was kind of, for the sake of the nation, was slow rolling some of the administration's decisions. So covert disobedience, basically. So I guess, you know, that's kind of the escalation of force, right? From Roger Natsir going to execute to covert disobedience. I'm not weighing in here saying, oh, this is right, that is right. That old IOC adage applies. It depends on the situation. But you can't simply say this is a black and white issue. You know, so those guys who did tell you that best military advice and then you salute and carry on just haven't thought hard enough about this. Or they've tried, but they just lack the intellectual capacity to understand it. Or they've tried and they themselves lack moral courage. And so they're like, no, that's too difficult, man. I'm just going to obey orders.
No, I think it's fascinating, and I think it's the discussion of our time because the guys, for instance, I asked you this a while ago, but most people couldn't tell you who the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was when we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. He is Richard Myers, an Air Force guy, right now.
You know, he was the blue potted plant because Myers was a die in the wall adherent of the philosophy of best military advice, and then you obey. Except there are those around him who said he didn't even offer very, you know, strongly worded best military advice. But that is why those around him referred to him as the blue potted plant. And there's a very interesting article written recently that I can't remember the name. I had to read it for this command and staff class that compared Newbold to Myers. And, you know, it was basically, hey, we got a 4-star general who thinks his only role is to simply obey. Why do we spend so much time nurturing these guys for that level of command?
Let me tell you what's even worse, Andy, is he grew up, right? Myers grew up in the shadow of Vietnam. He was one of those guys like Neller, right, who came into the military, never went to Vietnam, but spent his whole career essentially serving under Vietnam guys. And what was the seminal lesson of Vietnam? We will not do this again. The chest beating after Desert Storm, Desert Shield, of those guys who said, this is how it should be done. We've stayed out of these kind of conflicts right around the world, and now this is the way that you do it, all right? You don't get involved in those prolonged nation-building counterinsurgencies. You stay away from that stuff. When it's appropriate to use the military, you use it decisively, and they beat their chest. Guys like Myers grew up in that and then turned their back on it. And that's, to me, what's so damning about guys like Myers. He allowed Tommy Franks, right, to not have phase four articulated for him in either theater, and we still went to war. And to me, their sins are magnified by the environment that they grew up in and the lectures they received throughout their virtually entire career, and they betrayed that advice.
Yeah, I can agree more. It's very sad that at a critical juncture in our country's recent history, we had some guys at that nexus between the political and the military, who are basically just devoid of any of moral courage or intellect. You know, I mean, I think I read something recently that described Franks as being a brainless lout. You know, it's just a just a one of these dudes who looks good and, you know, big guy, speaks with a low voice and basically does nothing but still continues to get promoted. And I know you're going to get people who email you and say, "Who is this dude?" Just think, like, but that's
no. I mean, there is no other. Let me tell you, there is no other answer, because when they have to live under the bright white light of history, and when you scrutinize their decisions in that light, they don't stand up. Okay, they don't stand up, and all the things.
That's the thing. That's what burns me up. These aren't deliberate decisions. It's just a slide. Hey, I'm going to look the other way. I mean, and I'm going to shelter behind, again, this phrase, best military advice.
And then
behind the fact that no one goes after senior military officers. This is a paradox in our time, but no one goes after senior military officers for wars that just proved to be wasteful and ineffectual and achieved no lasting objective, no objectives at all.
Right. And then you see the same behavior in Africa. Once again, we have dead Americans there. Why? Did nobody undertake the security survey well and say, look, the terrain encroaches right on that base. If I was going to rank the number one place where we're likely to see some kind of an attack based on where they live, based on where they work, based on the layout of the base, based on the vegetation around it, this is your number one threat right here, right? Okay, well, how do we mitigate against that, right? And so if that wasn't done, I mean, come on. It's gross ineptitude, because we can't be fucking going down this road again. And so that's to me why, Andy, I think this is the single most important discussion that comes out of both Iraq and Afghanistan. How the fuck did we get escorted into these things that has changed the lay of the Middle East, has destabilized Europe, right? Has us spending trillions of dollars in those two places for what end?
That's why this whole question of dissent and understanding it is so important. And that is why, again, credit to Tom Gordon and Marine Corps Command and Staff College to set up a class with this title.
All right. What's next on your job? I got an email. And this is entitled Andy. I ordered Andy's book this weekend and got an email from Amazon saying the release date got pushed back a month. What is up, Andy?
We're trying to find that out today. Hey, thanks for mentioning my book again, by the way. So what we think is going on is that the initial run has sold out before it's even being released. But my edit firming that with Amazon, in which case they're going to rush another run over from the UK. Hey, I will say this though, honestly, if anyone's having this pushback, and I know I'm opening myself up here, but please send me an email, andrew.r.milburn@gmail.com. Send me a screenshot of when the book's being pushed back to, and I'll try and get you an answer. Yeah, the book comes out 22 February. So, Amazon normally delivers within 1 or 2 days of that. So I don't know why, myself included, we're getting these messages saying, hey, we're pushing back the delivery date, because everyone's confirming that 22 February is the date it's coming out. Meanwhile, in the UK, it came out on 3 February, and it's been top of the publisher's bestseller list there since then. And some of my friends, what they've been doing is just been ordering it directly from the publisher in the UK, because you bypass Amazon you pay a little bit more for postage, but it's £20 in the UK, which I forget, it's like, what, $24, $25 now, maybe a little more, $26. It's proving to be a better way to order it.
All right.
But I'll get an answer. Anyone wants to contact me, please feel free to do so.
No, you know, Andy, I can't tell you how much I enjoy this discussion because, again, you see the blood sacrifice that we make throughout our history and the requirement of the flag officers of the American military is to make sure that that is all synced up to our nation's strategic goals. And if it's not, then there ought to be an ethical and moral reaction from those people that are being asked to do something that's not ultimately in the nation's best interest. And I must not be understanding something. You must not be understanding something, because what you hear from 99.999% of general officers is, well, I could have resigned and that I would have had my 15 seconds of fame and then somebody else would have simply done it. I thought it was better that I stay involved, that I could help more on the inside. That's the answer you get virtually all the time.
That's right. But helping on the inside doesn't mean simply going ahead and trolling along and executing disastrous orders. So a couple of things real quick. But glimmer of hope. So after the command and staff class, they broke up into seminar groups, and I wandered around the seminars, sat in on the discussions there, and I'll tell you yes, we're talking about some of the brightest and best majors from all services. There at command and staff, but they all got it. I mean, they absolutely get what you just said and what we've been talking about. So there is definitely hope for future. The second point I wanted to make, which is an extremely important point. I'm 56, Mac, and I've got a, you know, we've been talking for a while and I've been drinking coffee. So maybe either play a commercial break or, you know, we can, I can bow out.
No, we're done. We are done. I'm done with you.
Pleasure. It's been again, man. I love our chat.
No, it's you know, Andy, one of the things that is most refreshing about you is you're not afraid. And so, I mean, a lot of guys come on All Marine Radio, but they're pretty, you know, they're pretty close to the vest and they're pretty party line when it comes to the things they'll say. And you are refreshingly unafraid. And again, what I love about what I do is concept of articulate discourse and articulate dissent, and nothing that Andy and I are talking about, we are saying is easy, because I mean you've worked your whole life to get someplace, and now you're at the pinnacle of achievement, and now you're going to walk away from it. I mean it's incredibly difficult, but I believe your oath to the nation says that should always not be far from your gaze. If I believe that this takes the nation in a fundamentally wrong direction, that I will stand up like General Shoup did during Vietnam, and he was ostracized, right? General Burrow didn't have one other general officer in the Marine Corps come to his defense when he said, "Yeah, we're going to go to an all volunteer Marine Corps, and I'm going to institute this thing called the expeditious discharge." Not one other officer came to his defense. He got told, "You are going to destroy the Marine Corps." Okay, and so there's a long history of great men who've dissented, and there's a long history of mediocre men who bobbleheaded and took the nation down bad roads. And so, to me, it's something that ought to be discussed on a regular basis, right? So that hopefully you plant the seeds that, look, dissent is as much your duty as assent and advises. So I think it's important.
Here's one other point on that. You're right on target. Here's one other point that I feel, you know, it's absolutely worth mentioning in closing. And for anyone who doesn't care about their oath of office or their professional ethics, there's one other piece of this that you just simply cannot ignore. You've done reenlistments, right?
Yes.
So enlisted Marines, what do they promise to do?
Obey the orders of the officers appointed above them.
Absolutely. What do we promise to obey anyone?
No.
No, we do not. We promise to well and faithfully discharge the duties and all that. But the guys beneath us, they promise to obey us. And that rests in our hands a weighty responsibility to ensure that we do not ask them to do anything dumb. Because we all know it is It is mission versus – it is mission first, men second. And we all know that in order to be a leader worth your salt will mean at times that you ask your subordinates to you direct them to do things that will cause them hardship and worse. But it has to be in a coherent cause. That's the implicit part of the difference in oaths. It has to be for a reason, right?
Right.
And if it isn't for a reason, then you can't simply default to what's the mission versus the men, right?
No,
maybe you can't.
I was saying earlier today about and you probably heard me say this, Andy. I used to do this thing when I gave my decision making class about let's talk about special trusted confidence. What does that mean? And sure. You know, you'd have the very quickly somebody would say, well, that's something Congress bestows on us. And I had this answer that used to like raise everybody's head. And I said, no, wrong answer. Fuck Congress, man. And then everybody would sit there and go, IOC is so cool. He just said, fuck Congress. And what I would say is, look, it doesn't have anything to do with Congress. It is the trust that the American people who give you their sons and daughters, their husbands and wives, their children, right? It is their children depending on you to do the right thing so that they have every chance to come home alive and can resume living the life that they want to live. That's what special trust and confidence is. It is a mantle somewhere in the Midwest that has a baby pitcher, a little league pitcher, a prom pitcher, a high school sports pitcher, and then a Marine in a set of dress blues in front of the Marine Corps, the national colors and the Marine Corps colors. Whether there may be any other pictures to the right of that may be a function of your ability to lead ethically. And you have to understand that. And if you're not up to it, then, as Gerald Mattis says, get out. This is too much for you. And I believe that for decades. And again, Vidman, if Vidman's career is over, good for him. He served honorably, right? Yeah, and it's unfortunate, and I hope that's not the case, but he did the right thing. He will not ever put his head on his pillow and not be able to go to sleep because of what he did.
But it's about the bigger picture, right? It's about what message is sent by that.
Well, when politicians enter, right, it is going nowhere but down. It will not be elevated.
And it's my fault for continuing the conversation. But in a moment, I'm going to have to pee in the swimming pool. Unless they go. I'm sorry to admit that on the radio.
Andy Milburn exiting stage left. Andy, thanks for the visit.
All right, man. All the best, Mac. It's been a pleasure.
All right. There you have it. His book is entitled When the Tempest Gathers. Okay. So that's Andy's book coming out already in the UK. And if you do a search on that, When the Tempest Gathers, you will be taken to sites that will certainly get you that book. So, my thanks to Andy for coming on today. And again, I do believe, that discussion is the most important discussion, that leaders of the American military have. And Andy quite rightly points out, you know, the officers of America's military occupy a unique position. The enlisted Marines under us obey our orders. So when you rise to the rank that you have a say in what's done and you fail, that's immoral. You're asking them to go risk their lives for something that's wrong. And there's no hiding you from that. That'll do it on a Monday. Just a note from a disgruntled artilleryman. I know all grunts want to be artillerymen, but the Raiders are at Las Flores, not Las Polga. So, Andy, what's up with that? So, for those of you that know, Las Polgas, which is Spanish for the fleas, yeah, not sure why we would put artillerymen in a place ripe with fleas, but anyway, the intersection of Las Flores and Bazelon Road, right by the Zulu impact area, is a home of the 11th Marine Regiment. That is Las Polgas. Las Flores is the one you can see from the freeway. As you're driving south off to the left, after you get by the Las Pulgas exit, you look over. Used to be the home of First Tanks, and they've gone to the desert for years and years and years. That's where First Tanks was. And now there's a whole Anglicos over there, LARs over there, Marsoc's over there. Who else? Anybody else? I'm not sure. But, yeah, that's who's there. So, anyway, just a point of clarity. Now, if you're just tuning in, I woke up at 3 in the morning or thereabouts, maybe before that, and I was wrestling with my conscience. Not my conscience, but my brain was telling me stuff. And you'll hear about that. I also went to a dinner on Saturday night, the 75th anniversary of Iwo Jima. They had, I want to say, 28 veterans from the battle still alive. Yeah, so 75 years ago, if you were 18 when you went ashore, you're 93 today. Yeah. So add 7 to that. If you were 25, so you're relatively young, you're 100 years old. Yeah. But it was a wonderful night, and I got a chance to meet Tony Kappa, and who I interviewed last week. It was an awesome night. And being in the company of those guys, awesome stuff. So, don't touch that dial. This program will repeat itself momentarily in case you missed the first part of it. And then tomorrow, Grant Newsham's going to join us. We're going to talk about coronavirus. And why has North Korea, man, why has he fallen off the radar all of a sudden? What happened to that? He was in the news all the time. You know, there was going to be a Christmas surprise for the United States, yet nothing transpired. What happened? So we'll talk to Grant about all that tomorrow. And then hopefully on Wednesday, head for Denver and go speak there and then come back Thursday. But and then we're going to talk about Iwo Jima on Thursday with Jeff Kenny and Tim Lynch. So they're both big fans. Timmy's going to a parade down in Texas, and that has the cast, the original cast that was done. They did it in Texas, and it's at the Marine Military Academy of Texas, something like that. So we'll hear about that. So, and then on Wednesday, which is the 19th, right, which is the day that Marines went ashore, I have interviews about Iwo Jima that I'm just going to stack up and play throughout the whole day. You'll hear from Cal Humphrey. You'll hear from Tony Kappa. You'll hear from Tony Zinni, general type, who's fascinated with the battle. You'll hear from Stephen Foley, who's a historian. You'll hear from Mary Reinwald, who sat on the Hewley board in its different sittings to continue to evolve who was actually in the second flag raising. And they're actually working on the first flag raising as well. So, yeah. So all kinds of just incredible history that is a part of the All Marine Radio reservoir. So I will tee that up on Wednesday. And everything from, like, live reports, if you've never heard them, they're pretty cool. And then just all the cool stuff that has been on. And I'm telling you. Fascinating interviews. So don't miss it. On a Monday, President's Day. Have a great day. All Marine Radio over and out.